طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Fan and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. In searching around for material for This Week in Palestine, I found a fascinating British show called Head to Head, which features sort of a debate format, which this particular week featured a discussion between Zionists Shlomo Ben-Ami and Paul Charney facing Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu and new historian and author Avi Schleim. It is moderated by Mehdi Hassan and takes place at the Oxford Union in the UK. If you want to hear the unraveling of the Zionist myth, you will enjoy this broadcast. Here is Head to Head, moderated by Mehdi Hassan.
It promised a land of safety and peace. But the Zionist dream became a Palestinian nightmare. Is Zionism still about the right to self-determination? Or is even its liberal variety just a form of colonialism? Today, Israel takes pride in saying it's the only democracy in the region. But for Palestinians living on both sides of the wall, things look very different. I'm Mehdi Hassan, and I've come here to the Oxford Union to go head-to-head with Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former Foreign Minister of Israel. One of the most influential voices on the Israeli left, he came close to ending the conflict in 2001, but failed. Today, I'll challenge him on whether liberal Zionism is compatible with liberal democracy, and whether it can ever produce a just settlement for the Palestinians. I'll also be joined by three experts tonight who will share their perspectives. Renowned Israeli historian Professor Avi Schleim, Paul Charney, chairman of the Zionist Federation of Great Britain, and Diana Boutu, a Palestinian lawyer and former PLO legal advisor. Ladies and gentlemen, Shlomo Ben-Ami. He considers himself an ardent Zionist, but also a liberal and left-wing Democrat.
Thanks, Shlomo, for coming. Thanks so much. Shlomo Ben-Ami, you would presumably describe yourself as a liberal, as a man of the left, as a Democrat, and yet you also describe yourself as an ardent Zionist. Is it possible to be both a liberal and a Zionist?
Of course it is possible. I would refer you to the initial Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel, where it says that this is about the ingathering of the exiles based on ancestral certificates of belonging, but one that is also respectful of the rights of minorities, ethnic groups, religions, gender. And I would add to it the definition that the founder of Zionism, Herzl, gave at the time, that this is about the creation of a Jewish state based on the laws of the nations. On international law, you would say today, if Israel respects all these parameters, this is the Zionism that I'm an ardent supporter of.
So how would you define Zionism in a way that's, say, different to the way that a settler defines Zionism, or even Benjamin Netanyahu defines Zionism?
Well, I say that in my book. I put the limits in the borders of 1948. I think that a state that is part of the community of nations should not settle beyond its internationally recognized borders. Admittedly, the 1948 borders were not recognized internationally, and one of the meanings, in my view, perhaps the main meaning of the 1967 war, is that it has legitimized the 1948 borders in the eyes of the Arab world.
How does a political ideology, which at its core is about privileging a particular ethnic group, presumably over other ethnic groups, how do you reconcile that with the principles of liberalism, which is about equal rights for all, equal citizenship for all?
I think you need an effort to reconcile the two, to square the circle. It's not easy. But I do agree that there is a fundamental anomaly in the creation of the State of Israel. This perhaps can explain the controversy around the Jewish state, because it was created in a very particular way. And given the background of Jewish history as we know it. But I do believe that enlightened leadership and more sober political construction in Israel could have reached that kind of squaring the circle.
But when you talk about squaring the circle or anomaly, some people go further. They say there is inherent, more than just a tension, there's a contradiction. When you talk of being a Jewish and democratic state, it's like talking about hot ice. It's a contradiction in terms, it's an oxymoron.
No, it is not an oxymoron. I mean, you can be a Jewish state where the Jews are a majority, but is fully, unconditionally respectful of the minorities. Look, without declaring it, many other states throughout the world gave priority to a majority ethnic or religion.
You're right. So if we take the United States, for example, you could say there's a big debate about indigenous people there, Australia. The difference, surely, is that in the nature of Zionism, surely it's about preserving a Jewish majority. And that Jewish majority, of course, came about by expelling some of the Palestinians who were living within those original borders, those UN-mandated borders. You wouldn't have a Jewish majority and a Jewish state had you not expelled Palestinians along the way.
Well, this is the way the State of Israel was created. I'm not trying to whitewash the anomaly in the creation of the State of Israel by saying that nations normally throughout history were born in blood and were born in sin. The difference is that Israel was born in the age of mass media. Imagine that the United States would have been born in the age of mass media after the elimination of the indigenous people.
Today, the United States does not say it is the nation or the country of one particular ethnic group or religion. And whereas the Jewish state is called the Jewish state, in its very title, is privileging one group of people over another group of people who happen to live within that state's borders. Well, that's why people talk about it's an ethnocracy, not a democracy, some suggest.
You need to see that against the background of Jewish history. Now what we need is to reconcile that complex historical background with what a normal state should be.
Let me go to our panel. Dr. Avi Schleim is one of Israel's best-known historians. He's a professor emeritus of international relations here at Oxford University. Professor Schleim, do you think there's a contradiction inherent within the Zionist project?
No, I do not think that liberalism and Zionism are a contradiction in terms. Zionism isn't a monolithic movement. Zionism is a pluralist movement, and there are many different strands of Zionism. And Professor Ben-Ami represents the most liberal strand within the Zionist movement, and he represents the views of a handful, a few percent of the Israeli population. But mainstream Zionism has never been liberal. The gap between the lofty Zionist ideals and the reality of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians on the ground has always been so huge that Zionist leaders filled it with hypocrisy and humbug.
You describe yourself, I believe, as a post-Zionist. What is that?
It means that I'm not an anti-Zionist because I accept Zionism as the national liberation movement of the Jews. But I believe that the Zionist project was achieved by 1967. There was a viable Jewish state in the Middle East. And I would have liked Israel to have given back all the territories to trade them for peace so that everyone could get on with their lives, okay. Both Israelis and Arabs. And 1967 is the great watershed. Before 1967, Israel had considerable international legitimacy. It lost it in the aftermath of the war because it became a colonial power, okay. Ruling over an Arab population.
Let me bring in Paul Charney, who is chairman of the Zionist Federation of Britain and Ireland, a former lieutenant in the Israeli army. Avi Schleim says that there's no inherent contradiction, he believes, between Zionism and liberalism and democracy, but the gap has been filled. In practice, the gap has been filled by hypocrisy and humbug. What's your response to that?
I disagree with the premise of the question. I disagree with some of what my esteemed colleague has been saying. Let's come back to what Zionism is. Zionism was formed in the late 19th century as an answer, as a solution to the Jewish people who were persecuted around the world. The world itself defined Zionism by telling the Jewish people, no matter where you live, at any point of history, at any time, you are not safe. And the liberal Zionists at the time came up with the conclusion that we need a Jewish homeland, a safe Jewish homeland, in our Jewish historical national homeland for the Jewish people, and then we will be safe.
Let me bring in Diana Boutu, who is a Palestinian law and activist, former legal advisor to the PLO between 2000 and 2005. And I believe your parents were born in what is now Israel, and you have Israeli citizenship as well. Shlomo Ben-Ami says every country is born in sin. Why is, do you think Israel is any different then?
It's very different. The fact of the matter is that the Zionist movement and Zionism on the ground is the idea of creating not only a Jewish state, but at the expense of the indigenous Palestinian population. What Zionism is the idea of privileging and giving exclusive rights to one group of people at the expense of another group of people. This isn't liberal. This isn't relating to equality. There isn't a single Zionist who's able to say that they actually believe that Palestinians have the exact same rights as Israelis who are living in that country. And this is the fundamental problem with Zionism.
What's your response to Diana?
Well, Arab Israelis share in some way the predicament of Jews in the diaspora in the following sense, that they are equal by the law to the Jewish part of the population. But real life has discriminated against Arab Israelis in many fields.
700,000 Palestinians left what is now Israel. They didn't just all run away out of choice. In many cases, they were driven out. Do you accept that you would not have the Jewish majority and the Jewish state today without that original act, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, the catastrophe?
History offered different options. 1947 was one option. You could have had an Israeli Jewish state without expulsion.
But if you had the expulsion, you wouldn't have a Jewish majority.
This fact of history is today one of the major reasons that the Israeli right of center is ready to engage in a peace process in order to give away lands in the West Bank. The fear of a demographic doomsday. Mm. That's always been one of the central issues in this process.
And would you accept that the Jewish state was built on an act of ethnic cleansing then?
Well, there were elements of ethnic cleansing, there is no doubt about it. The story of Lida, no, of Lod. So there were obviously cases, and there were many other cases where the country was bisected by war, and people ran away out of fear. I don't believe that there was a master plan.
Let's assume it was all an accident. Let's assume the Palestinians all ran away out of choice. You didn't let them come back. It's all very well acknowledging the history and saying that was unfortunate, this may have been ethnic cleansing. But I'm asking you, you say today I'm an ardent Zionist. That's part of the legacy of Zionism.
I accept it as it is.
But you don't say I don't want to therefore take the tag of an ideology that produced that.
I'm trying to reconcile the price that was paid by everybody in this conflict with a decent state of affairs. That is what is to be liberal today.
Well, let's talk about that, but Paul Charney wants to come in here. Paul?
In the 1950s, there is a Jewish majority in that land because the Arab nations expelled 800,000 Jews and they had nowhere to go but Israel. The Arabs have created as much of a Jewish population in Israel as the Palestinians leave.
Why haven't the refugees been allowed to return? Because the fundamental issue is that you view Palestinians as a demographic threat and that you don't believe in equality for Palestinians.
I want to pick up what Shlomo said about dealing with now, the consequences of now. I hear a lot of people on the left in Israel say, you know, we're opposed to the settlements are bad, don't judge us on the base settlements, we're against settlements too. And there's this sense that settlements are somehow alien, distinct, different to Israel proper. Isn't the problem here that you can't distinguish the two, that they are part and parcel of the same enterprise?
Yes, I think Israel hasn't been able to overcome the hangover from the years prior to the State of Israel, where settling the land was made by outsmarting the British and outwitting the Arabs. 1967 unleashed this spirit of the old Jewish community in Palestine, of settling the land. And I think that it's about time to put an end to it.
When I hear people in Israel talking about settlements, there's two different types. There's someone like yourself saying it's time to bring it to an end. And we had Danny Dayan on this show, the former leader of the West Bank settlers, sitting in that very chair last year on Head to Head. And he said, quote, "If Tel Aviv is not a colonialist project, then Maaleh Shomron, the West Bank settlement where he lives, is not a colonialist project. I.e., if the settlements are colonialist and illegitimate, then so too is Tel Aviv, so too is Haifa." He's got a point, isn't he? He's kind of bluntly honest about
this. No, he doesn't have a point. This is a silly argument. This is a totally silly argument. Simply because 1948 is a reality that is now regionally, internationally recognized. And going beyond 1948, settling in the West Bank today, which is what remains for the Palestinians to have their own sovereign, decent state, you need to put limits to the sin. There has been, as I said, a sin in the creation of the State of Israel, as I do believe that there has been a sin in the creation of many nations throughout history. But you need to put a limit. And the limit, the reasonable limit, is the state of 1948. And going beyond that by saying that Tel Aviv is also a settlement is political pornography.
Okay. Let me ask Diana Bhutu, when you hear someone like Shlomo Ben Ami here on the left of the Israeli political spectrum saying political pornography, what's your response?
I hate to agree with Danny Dayan, but in a way he's absolutely right. I mean, the fact that we're trying to make a distinction between what happened in 48 and what happened in 67 is a false distinction to be making. Zionism, at its fundamental core, is the idea of privileging one group of people over another. And the way that they created a Zionist state in the first place was to expel millions, hundreds of thousands, now millions of Palestinian refugees, including my family. And the way that you create a bigger Zionist state is to do the exact same process. I think that it's important to keep in mind that between the period of 1948 and 1967, which people are sort of trying to idealize as being the great years of Israel, there were Palestinians who were citizens of that state were living under military rule.
Let me just ask you this. In the past 60 years, roughly 700 Jewish communities have been established inside the 1967 borders. Do you know how many have been established for Arab citizens?
I guess none.
Seven. Seven. Yeah. So when you see a statistic like that, how can you say that this is a country which treats its Arab citizens and its Jewish citizens equally?
I say equal according to the law, not reality. I say it very clearly. And this is one major assignment that the State of Israel still has. That is to turn this equality according to the law into a reality, a social and political
law. From the very beginning, there have been laws discriminating against Palestinians living in Israel.
I'm not going to be the advocate of these policies. These are the policies upon which the State of Israel was built. Israel is driven by a paranoia with regard to the Arab world. The dilemma of the Arab Israelis is of a people whose people is at war with its state. And this is a very, very odd condition that you don't find among other nations. And therefore, everything that happens is conditioned by these contradictions that are inherent in the creation of the State of Israel.
Could a Palestinian ever be Prime Minister of Israel?
Well, history will tell.
If you had a Palestinian Prime Minister, then why call yourself a Jewish state?
Because the state so far has this preoccupation with being the refuge, of being the shelter of the Jews, given the historical background. We have a particular history, and the Jewish state, its formation, its constitution, has much to do with this burden
Agreed.
Of history.
I don't think anyone would dispute the burden, the suffering, the persecution. That's not what's at stake. I think the issue is that the right to self-determination of Jews came at the expense of the equal rights of other people and continues to come at the expense
and
of other people.
And this is, as I say, this is the assignment of liberal Zionists, to try and put an end to this and put a limit to this inequality. Peace with the Palestinians would be a major step towards such a goal.
You would accept, surely, at the very minimum, what we've just discussed, that Arabs are discriminated against legally in an institutionalized fashion.
They are, but less and less. I think Israel is making headway in reconciling itself with
well,
its Arab minority.
Let's ask our panel, Paul Charney. You would accept that Arab citizens of Israel are treated differently to Jewish citizens of Israel?
Let's look at it this way. There was no Palestinian liberation movement in the West Bank prior to 1967.
That's not the question I asked. Do you accept that Arab citizens in Israel are treated differently to Jewish citizens in Israel?
I accept that Israel has some way to go for all its citizens to be 100% equal in its society. Not in the law, but in the society. And that takes time.
What does that mean, not in the law?
That means that just in every democratic society around the world, minorities are treated in some circumstances differently to the majorities, including this country here.
Really?
Yes.
In this country, people are treated in as this an ethnic country, group, are you, defined as you, an ethnic group
you
and treated differently.
You will see parties like the BNP talk about different races and different
So you're comparing
minorities.
Israel to the British National Party, a far-right fascist party.
I'm comparing Israel to a conglomerate of democratic parties just like the UK.
Okay. Let me ask Avi Shloim to respond
I'd
to that.
I'd like to disagree with Please. Professor Ben-Ami when he says that Israel is less and less discriminatory. I think that's the exact opposite of the truth, because ever since the breakdown of the Camp David conference summit, Israel has been moving further and further to the right. And today we have a prime minister who embodies the most right-wing, xenophobic, exclusivist and racist brand of Zionism. And his government is an extremely chauvinistic government, which not only is opposed to any withdrawal on the West Bank, in other words, it's opposed to peace with the Palestinians, but it's also increasingly discriminatory towards the Arab minority within Israel.
Diana Bouti, what do you make of the argument from liberal Zionists, not so liberal Zionists, that everyone inside of Israel is treated equally by the law, if not in practice?
Absolute rubbish. First and foremost, I think it's important to go through some of the laws just so that people get a
Very
flavor
briefly.
Of what these laws are about. First of all, immigration issues. My family hails from a town that is in the Galilee, and they were ethnically cleansed from their homes in 1948, have never been allowed to return back, even though they themselves are citizens of the state of Israel, were considered present absentees. My family, some of whom actually fled to other Arab countries, including Jordan, have never been allowed to return to their home inside what is present-day Israel, but for one reason and only one reason, because they're not Jewish. Another law that the Knesset has recently passed is a law that allows communities to be able to discriminate against people who decide to move into those areas. So, for example, if you are Arab, there are communities that are specifically designed to weed you out because they don't want any Palestinians living amongst them.
It's true. That's a reality. And it is not a reality that should be condoned. They come from something which is inherent in a movement that wants demographic majority. The same drive that will eventually bring about the creation of a Palestinian state, simply because this drive to be Jewish majority is what will prevent the annexation of the West Bank.
Just to come back to my earlier question, because this is the key here, you don't accept that your definition, which you'd use the phrase demographic and demographic drive and demographic majority, is a definition of an ideology that doesn't match most other political ideologies.
It is the result of Jewish history that brings us to want to have a Jewish majority. If it continues to be preserved and a limit is not put to it, it becomes racism, and this is exactly what people like myself and many others would like to put an end to.
We're going to take a break now. In part two, I want to talk to you about the peace negotiations that you engaged in when you were foreign minister of Israel, slightly over a decade ago. And we're also going to be talking to our audience here at the Oxford Union. So stay tuned for part two of Head to Head with Shlomo Ben-Ami. Welcome back to part two of Head to Head. We've been talking about liberal Zionism. Is there a contradiction between liberalism and Zionism? Our guest today is the former foreign minister of Israel, Shlomo Ben-Ami. In part two, in this part, I'd like to talk about some of your experiences as a negotiator at Camp David, as a foreign minister for Israel at the Taba Peace Summit in January 2001. We're always talking about the peace process, quote-unquote peace process. And what I wanted to ask is whether this process was all ultimately a waste of time, because two decades later, we talked about settlements in part one, the number of settlements doubled during that time. The Palestinians still don't have a state, still haven't ended the occupation. There's still no peace in the Middle East.
Well, it was not a waste of time. I think that we reached a point where we all understand what is the price of peace. When we came to the Madrid Peace Conference, we thought that peace is not about all the land, and the Arabs thought that it is not about all the peace. Today we do understand that this is about all the land and all the peace. That's one lesson. Another thing that was not a waste of time is that the peace process managed to bring into the idea of a two-state solution the Israeli center and the right of center. What is a waste of time is to insist on the paradigm. The paradigm of a peace negotiated directly between Israelis and Palestinians is not valid anymore, in my view.
Taba in January 2001, where you led the Israeli negotiating team, how close do you think you came to an agreeing comprehensive peace deal between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
I think we came very close. What happened to us is what happens in many other peace processes, where the political calendar clashes with the logic of the process. And we were very close to elections. Arafat was unwilling to strike a deal with a moribund government. He truly believed that with Bush Jr. he might have a better deal. He remembered Bush Sr., but Bush Jr. turned out to be not the son of his father.
Your old boss.
It turned out to be the son of Reagan.
But your old boss, Ehud Barak, didn't really want to do a deal either.
That's not true. He was very keen on having an agreement. He came to the peace process the way Rabin came. He was not a peacenik. He saw it as a central pillar for Israel's security. And he wanted it very, very strongly.
What I'm confused about is I read your book, Scars of War, Wounds of Peace, and I'm slightly confused because on the one hand you say things like, if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David, the peace offer at Camp David.
But not Taba, I said Camp David.
You also say in 2001 after Taba, you say, quote, Arafat doesn't accept us, you said at the time. Neither he nor the Palestinian National Movement accept us. Contrary to the Zionist movement, they are incapable of compromising.
Let me explain what I mean by this. You see, for the Egyptians and the Syrians, a peace agreement with Israel is about real estate. It is about a piece of land. We gave back the Sinai Peninsula and we got a peace treaty. When it comes to the Palestinians, this is not about the political recognition of the State of Israel. It is about the moral recognition of the State of Israel. It goes into intangible, non-tangible issues. And for them, it is extremely difficult. I still don't have an answer if he did want a deal or he did not want a deal. And I'm saying that from a very, very favorable opinion to Arafat. You see, for him to recognize the State of Israel was to recognize this state that was born in sin. It was to confer to Israel a moral legitimacy, which is not the kind of legitimacy that the Egyptians were about to confer to us. They gave us political legitimacy. So that this is where, given the context of the Palestinian tragedy that has some sort of cosmic dimensions, all political solutions fell short of reconciling this tragedy. And this is where I see the difficulty of the Palestinians to reach a deal.
Let me put some of your comments to our panel. Diana Bhutu, you were obviously a legal advisor at the time when all of this was going on. Were you incapable of compromise?
Look, I was also present at Taba, and this is what compromise is in the Israeli mindset. They take the land claim that it's theirs, and then they make concessions on land that doesn't actually belong to them. And this is the way that the Zionist movement is about. So at Taba, Taba didn't really differ very much from Camp David. The Israelis were still willing to take,
you wanted
the Ariel block, wanted Ma'ale Adumim, wanted to take large swaths of Palestinian land. There was still no recognition that Palestinians have a right to return to their homeland. There was still no compensation that was going to be paid. It was still this idea of continual control over Palestinian lives. Okay, what concessions are in Israeli mindset.
Paul Charney, if you were at Taba, would you have signed the deal, the kind of deal that Shlomo Ben Ami was talking about at the time?
So long as Israelis can live in a secure, safe environment, I would be happy to sign the Taba deal.
Paul privileges Israel's security. For him, what matters above everything else is Israel's security. He completely ignores Palestinian rights, both individual rights and collective rights. Now, the trouble with the Israeli concept of security is that Israel wants 100% security for itself, which means zero security for the Palestinians. And I would say that the American-sponsored peace process since 1991 is an exercise in futility, because it's all process and no peace. Benjamin Netanyahu pretends that he wants to negotiate with the Palestinians, but he keeps expanding Israeli settlements. He's like a man who pretends to negotiate over the division of a pizza, and he keeps eating it.
Avi Shlomo talked about all process, no peace. And a lot of people who were supporters of a peace process and a two-state solution along Oslo grounds, Camp David grounds, Taba grounds, now say it can't happen, it won't happen. And they would say that a one-state solution, a secular binational state of Palestinians and Jews living side by side, is the only option. You say in your book and elsewhere it's utterly unrealistic, it's nonsense. Others would say it's inevitable.
If we go back to the demography question, I think that if the two-state solution doesn't work, you will see an Israeli unilateral withdrawal from the bulk of the West Bank, precisely because of the demographic issue. Why did Sharon disengage from Gaza and dismantle the settlements that he himself had created because of demography?
Do you see Palestinians as a demographic threat to Israel? Do you use that language?
It does not respond to the original plans of Zionism.
What proportion of the Israeli population in an ideal world, in Shlomo Ben Ami's ideal, would be Palestinian?
It's
an important question. If you're going to talk about demography, how many Palestinians is too many?
I can't say that. I don't know.
If it was 51% Palestinian, would that be a problem for you as a liberal Zionist?
I guess not, but as a whole, the state needs to have a Jewish majority, because that was the initial idea. This is the essential ideology.
You're contradicting yourself. You're saying, I guess not to 51%, but the state needs to have a Jewish majority.
You are discussing with me mathematics. I'm talking about the principle.
In a Jewish state, with a quote-unquote demographic threat, or demographic race is the phrase you use in your book, how many Palestinians is too many?
How many Muslims do you want in Britain? You're trying to turn Israel as a special case.
It is a special case. Okay. It's the only democracy that defines itself on ethnic grounds.
But there are others that do not define, but do it in practice.
In practice, okay. Yeah. Let me...
For example, the Arab world is... Arab states are not Muslims.
I don't think the Arab states have ever claimed to be Western liberal democracies. Avi Shlaim, every country does it.
We are talking about Israel, not about other countries. And Israel, within its pre-1967 borders, is a democracy, a flawed democracy, but Israel plus the occupied territories is most emphatically not a democracy. It's an ethnocracy where one ethnic group dominates over
the
other.
And very quickly, are you a supporter of a two-state solution, or do you think a one-state solution is now inevitable, or a unilateral withdrawal to you?
All my life I supported a two-state solution, but now I believe that the two-state solution is dead. It's dead as a dodo. It's dead as the Oxford dodo, which you can see at the entrance to the Pitt Rivers Museum, not very far.
It's dead. We get it.
And Israeli governments destroyed the two-state solution. systematically destroyed the basis for a viable Palestinian state.
Paul, how many Palestinians is too many in Israel today?
Judaism and Jews are a fundamental part of the nationality, the national outlook of Israel. It's a fundamental part. And if you said in Britain today that you would open your borders to immigration from around the world, you would have riots on your hands.
I ask you a question. Are Palestinians immigrants in their own land?
Not just Palestinians. Israel will limit its immigration of any nationality, of any people around.
Paul, it's a very simple question. Are Palestinians immigrants in their own land?
Non-Israelis, which is fundamentally part of Judaism, are limited in the amount of people that can come into Israel.
This is precisely the face of Zionism, the fact that Israel comes to me and now I'm considered to be an immigrant to that country. This is precisely the ideology. The problem with Israel is that it views me either as a demographic threat or as a security threat. And if you look at Israel today, it already is one state. It's no longer a question of whether it's going to be one state. It is one state. The problem today is it's apartheid. That's what we're living under.
Let me go to our audience now. We've been waiting very patiently. Okay, gentleman here waving his hand.
Mr. Ben-Ami, you may or may not have a right to a state, but why should we Palestinians have to suffer so that you have a state? How is that fair? And why am I being denied my right to visit the village of my grandfather, which is only 10 kilometers to the east of Gaza? And let me remind the audience, the whole world, which has been under siege for the past 7 years by your government. Thank you.
I hope that this two-state solution at some point down the road will materialize, and we will have peace with the Palestinians, and we can visit peacefully Palestine, and Palestinians can visit peacefully Israel.
What about the earlier part of his question, which was about statehood for the Jews came at the expense of Palestinians? How is that right? The Palestinians are the Jews of the Jews.
If this is what he says, And if these were the reality, then he's right. But there is a shared responsibility. There must be a shared responsibility why the Palestinians do not have their own state. We need to go back again to history and see why in 1947 it did not happen. Why in 1937 it did not happen. The Palestinians were offered a state, never a perfect state, three times. And three times they rejected it. So this is part of the story. You cannot go into the movie, in the middle of the movie, and say, okay, this is what happens. You need to go to the origins. And in the origins, there were Israeli sins, and there were Palestinian political miscalculations and wrong decisions that brought them to this situation. And as a brilliant Palestinian scholar, Yazid Sayeg, wrote, if this kind of decision-making by the Palestinian leadership persist, they might end, this is a Palestinian saying, like the Kurds, with the right cause but with no solution. Just shared responsibility when political decisions need to be taken.
Just very, very quickly, Avi Schleim, you're here, you're famous for being one of the new historians. I'm just wondering what your take is in terms of apportioning blame for the fact that the Palestinians don't have a state today or don't have justice.
Whichever way you look at the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, it involved a monumental injustice to the Palestinians.
Okay, let's take some more questions. I'm going to go back to the back. Who's got their hand up highest? Oh, that guy put his hand up very high.
Thank you for this event. I'm not a Jewish or Palestinian, but as someone who's outside the conflict, it seems that as a liberal, you said you support international law, which includes not only ending the occupations and granting equal rights to Palestinian citizens of Israel, but also implementing UN 242, right? The right of return of the refugees in the diaspora. And so my question is, why shouldn't we boycott Israel, divest from Israel, impose sanctions on Israel until it meets that minimum standard of international law, ending the occupations, granting equal rights, and allowing the right of return? It worked in South African apartheid. Why shouldn't we apply the same strategy here? Okay.
242. Okay. 242 is not about ending occupation. 242 is about negotiating the end of occupation. And this was negotiated by some Israeli governments in good faith And this is where you can discuss the question of shared responsibility. Why we did not reach an agreement in Camp David? Why we did not reach an agreement in Taba? Why we accepted the Clinton peace parameters and the other side did not accept them? So there was an attempt to reach a solution.
What about refugees?
About refugees, 194, this is another example of these divergent rhythms of decision-making between Israelis and Palestinians. 194 was rejected by the entire Arab world. And in Lausanne, Israel proposed 100,000 return of refugees. I admit that it was done as a tactic, but it was not accepted by the Arab world. Today, 100,000 refugees returning to Israel would have been a glorious achievement.
I'm assuming you don't agree with boycotting Israel, but do you understand where that sentiment comes from, that people do see these kind of discriminatory laws, they do see these injustices, and they say, what else should we do? A peaceful means of trying to put pressure on Israel.
I think that that what they should do is push their governments to put pressure on the parties to reach a settlement. Sanctions need to be ruled out in this context.
Diana Bhutto, do you support, as a Palestinian, the boycott, divestment and sanction movement, the
Absolutely.
BDS movement?
Absolutely. This is the only way that Israel's going to get the message that it's not above international law and that the Palestinians are not beneath international law.
Okay, back to the audience. Lady here in the front row in the grey jacket. Do you want to speak up, please?
You acknowledge that there is a gap between the equality that Israeli Arabs receive under the law and the equality they receive from their Jewish Israeli neighbours. What practical solutions can you describe right now for addressing and changing that mindset?
Well, the only practical solution is more proactive policies by Israeli governments. What strikes me in the behavior of Likud right now is this Tea Party emergence within Likud that goes against the initial philosophy of the Israeli right. Because, surprisingly, they always believed in a fair deal to the Palestinians.
Okay, gentleman here in the tie, on my right, third row back.
Professor Ben-Ami, you're talking about peace negotiations and two-state solution, but at the end of the day, in negotiation, the devil is in the details. Can you envisage an Israel government that will meet the minimum requirement on issues like refugees, Jerusalem, even the swap of lands? And if I can take it further, the Arab initiative, the Saudi initiative, can you see any option for it to be revived? Is it valuable to revive it now, or it's all done and dead?
I don't see an Israeli government in the foreseeable future that will meet the minimal requirements of the Palestinians for statehood. When we went to Taba, the negotiating team which I headed, you cannot imagine in the Israeli political map a team more to the left. The Palestinians rejected also the Geneva Accords. The political career of Yasser Abedrabo was destroyed because he was party to the Geneva Accords. So one asks oneself, what is that minimum?
Because there is a problem. The current Israeli government should sign up to the Saudi peace plan, which has been on the table for a while.
Not only the current Israeli government. I think that the governments from 2002 lost a historic opportunity to subscribe to the plan. By the way, the plan, when it comes to Jerusalem, goes beyond what the Palestinians agreed at Camp David and in Taba, which is not the division of Jerusalem east-west, but the division of Jerusalem along ethnic lines, which are the Clinton peace parameters. So I think that this is a workable, a livable plan that an Israeli government should have subscribed to.
You don't think it's going to happen anytime soon?
I don't see that, because the political map has shifted, as Avi said, rightly to the right, and Likud even has become an ungovernable party.
Let's come back to the audience here. Let's come back to the lady three rows down with her hand up. Yes, on my left.
I just wanted to know, as a liberal Zionist who embraces the idea of equality in Israel for the Arab citizens of Israel, and I am an Arab citizen of Israel, how would you move forward in advancing this population? And would you agree to affirmative action policies that would advance this minority in Israel?
Absolutely. I would subscribe to affirmative action. I would subscribe to affirmative action.
Okay, let's go back to the audience. Lady here on my left.
I wanted to ask you, going back to this divide between 1948 and 1967, you've made a compelling argument tonight as a liberal Zionist that the problem is the occupation and not the original sin of 1948. But we know that at this forum down in Diana said that he rejects this, and Diana Bhutto, our esteemed colleague here, has also said that this is really one and the same. And given these opinions of members of both nationalist camps who are not considered radicals within their own movements, what gives you hope for the two-state solution going forward?
No, I'm not extremely hopeful. If the current paradigm continues, where the two parties are supposed to reach a settlement, there will not be a solution. A solution has to have an ingredient of imposition. It has to come from the international community. What you need is a peace plan that would become the internationally accepted interpretation of 242.
When you talk about hopefulness and what's going to happen with the Palestinian Israelis, I just want to read one quote to you that you said when you were on Democracy Now!, the American radio show a few years ago. You said that you support concessions, quote, not because I'm concerned with the future of the Palestinians or because I'm concerned with international law. It is because I define myself as an ardent Zionist that thinks the best for the Jews in Israel is that we abandon the territories. It's not because I'm concerned with the Palestinians. I want to be very clear about that. My question is, as a liberal, shouldn't you also be concerned about the Palestinians? It shouldn't just be a cynical exercise in saving Israel.
I shifted in that particular answer. Where is the core of my drive to reach a settlement? The fact that I think this is the best for the Jewish state, for all reasons, for political reasons, for international reasons, and for moral reasons, because there is a spillover of the practices that one exercises in the territories into the state of Israel. So I think that it includes everything.
One last question for the gentleman who waited very patiently in the back.
Dr. Ben-Ami, does there come a point where Zionism, where the mistakes of war and the actions of extremism, is, the mistakes of war, as you call them, when those destroy the moral ascendancy in your eyes of Zionism as an ideology?
Well, Netanyahu is obsessed with absolute security, something that is utterly unrealistic. And in fact, this drive to have absolute, total security is not possible to implement. And therefore, you can see him insisting on a continuous presence of Israel in the Jordan Valley.
Does a point come where you say, as a fellow Zionist to Benjamin Netanyahu on a different part of the spectrum, where you say, this project just doesn't, I can't sign up to him, I can't be an ardent Zionist anymore, given what things have happened in the names of Zionists?
If he distorted the idea, it doesn't oblige me to abandon my credo. I mean, I think that this is his view. It's not a monolithic ideology. People gave it different interpretations, as in every other nation.
Just before we finish, 13 years ago, you say you came very, very close to a peace deal at Taba. 13 years from now, what is that region going to look like? What's going to be happening in Israel and Palestine? What's your prediction?
I think that Israel condemns itself to perdition if it doesn't reach a settlement whereby you will have a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. You have condensed this debate into the moral sphere. History is not a department of moral philosophy, not for the Israelis and not for any other nation in the planet. If you see that from a political and strategic perspective, I think that this is the end of the Jewish state. This is the end of the initial Zionist idea if we do not have a Palestinian state, morally, politically, strategically. For me, a Palestinian state is not the objective. For me, this is the instrument, the tool, the way to reconcile ourselves with the entirety of the Arab and Muslim world. And this is the strategic meaning of a Palestinian state. And this is why I want it. If it doesn't happen, what we will see is something similar to what Ariel Sharon did in Gaza, a unilateral withdrawal.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shlomo Ben-Ami, for joining us here on Head to Head. Thank you all for coming to the Oxford Union tonight. Thanks to our panel. And thanks to you all for watching at home. Head to Head will be back next week. Good night.
You have been listening to the British program Head to Head at the Oxford Union in Oxford, England. Zionists under scrutiny in a debate format come up against the facts and reality and get hammered, as we just heard. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBZ.org. If you want to sleep a little later on Sunday morning and want to hear the program later in the day or at any other time of the week via the instant archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on the WZBC Archive for only 2 weeks. You can then find this and all our past broadcasts on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. Click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there due to the diligence of our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.